The title for this conference is The Two Houses. At the conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 7 of Matthew's Gospel, Jesus talks about two houses, one built on rock and the other built on sand. Anyone who hears my words and puts them into practice is like a wise person who builds his house on rock. When the rains come and the winds blew, they buffeted that house, but it did not collapse because it was solidly built on rock. Whereas anyone who hears my words but does not put them into practice is like a foolish person who builds a house on sand. The rains fell, the torrents came, and the winds blew and lashed against that house, and it collapsed under all this and was completely ruined. We might think of these two houses as two examples of the way we live. The house, therefore, symbolizes our life. And Jesus is telling us that we have a choice between building our life on his teachings, on the words of the gospel, and in a very special way upon the words of the Sermon on the Mount. And if we will take seriously these teachings of Jesus in the Beatitudes and in the Sermon on the Mount and in the rest of the Gospels, then it means that we will build our life on solid rock. And therefore, when the storms come and we are buffeted in various directions, that we will stand firm, that our life will survive, because it is built on the Word of God, on the teaching of Jesus. Whereas if we ignore these teachings of Jesus, if we do not put them into practice, Jesus says it is like building our life on sand. The house will stand for a while as long as things are quiet and peaceful, but in time of storm, that house will collapse. Our life will just disintegrate because it is built on sand rather than rock. What would be some of the examples of people who build their house upon sand, who build their life upon other values than the teachings of the gospel? In general, we could say anyone that builds one's life on worldly goods, on such things as money, power, worldly fame, pleasure, success. These are people who are building their life on sand. And we know that these things can all be lost in a stock market crash, for example. We know that they all collapse and disappear at the moment of death, which we could think of as a storm that strikes our life. These are the things that are the number one priority in the lives of many, many people. It is very helpful to meditate on this teaching of Jesus and to realize that anyone that builds one's life on such worldly values is building his or her life on sand. As we see the apparent success of people of the world, people who get ahead and have very much of the goods of this world, most of us at times feel envy or jealousy. We want to emulate them. We think that that is the right way to happiness. But Jesus is telling us here at the end of the Sermon on the Mount that we are mistaken, that this is only an apparent success, that this is exactly like a beautiful house that someone might build too close to the ocean without the proper pilings, and just erect that house there on the sand dune. We know that as long as everything is quiet, as long as there are no storms around, that house is still livable, and we can continue to enjoy it. But we know, and we have seen examples along the seacoast of what happens in time of a storm for a house that is built too close to the water, that is built too much on sand without on solid rock. The house collapses, and great is the fall thereof, as Jesus says. What then does it mean to build one's house on rock? The old hymn, Rock of Ages, refers to, again, this particular scripture text, and is reminding us that Jesus Christ is the Rock of Ages, that this is the rock on which we are to build our house. Rock of Ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. We might think of this rock as God Himself or as Jesus Christ. We might think of this rock as love, the three relationships of love, love of neighbor, love of self, and love of others. We might think of this rock as those three virtues, the basic virtues on which our whole life is to be built, namely faith, hope, and charity. Or we might think of this rock as trust in God, having this total, complete faith and trust in God that results in a tremendous love of God. Or another way of thinking of this rock on which to build our life is if we would think of God as personifying all of those so-called transcendental values in life. And what are the transcendental values of life? Transcendental. They transcend the earthly goods, the earthly values, which is what it means to build our life on sand. Some of the transcendental values of life are love, truth, goodness, beauty, justice, mercy, forgiveness, generosity, peace, unity, and so on. These are the lasting values. These are the values that will be just as important for each one of us 100 years from now, long after we have died and continue to live in eternity, as they are for us now. Transcendental. They transcend this earth. They continue to live on beyond our death. They are everlasting values. And we say that God is the personification of these values. God is truth itself. God is love itself. God is life itself. God is goodness itself. God has all of these values, and they are a part of His nature. He personifies them. He makes them into a real person. And if we build our whole life on these transcendental values, then we are building our life, our house, on solid rock, that death or any other earthly storm cannot destroy it, that it will continue to stand and exist forever and ever. And one of the ways to ask ourselves whether we are building our life on solid rock, on these transcendental values, is to ask ourselves, in regards to the things that we do each day, how important will these things be for me and for other people 100 years from now. You could, of course, say 1,000 years from now, but let's just say 100 years from now. Certainly the love that a person shows to one's family, to one's spouse and children and parents, that is a transcendental value that will be important, that will still be present and lasting even 100 years from now. Any time that we practice love, love of God, love of neighbor, and a proper love of self, this is definitely a transcendental value that will live on, that has everlasting value. And that's the kind of life Jesus says that we will build if we take seriously his teachings, if we try to carry out as literally and as best we can the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount. In chapter 7 of St. Matthew's Gospel, Jesus tells us to be on our guard against false prophets who come to us in sheep's clothing, but underneath are wolves on the prowl. And he gives us a way by which we can determine whether a particular prophet is a true prophet or a false prophet. And it comes down simply to this: by their fruits you will know them. And so when we talk about these everlasting values, we're talking about fruits. If the things that we do, or if the things that someone tells us that we should do, if they have eternal value, if they will be able to exist and help people, if they contribute in some way to love of God and love of neighbor and love of self, in a permanent, everlasting way, then they are true fruits. And that person who recommends them is a true prophet. Many people would like to have it both ways, would like to have their cake and eat it too. In other words, we find ourselves being attracted both to worldly, earthly values, to the things of this world, such as possessions and pleasures and power and so on. And we also find ourselves pulled towards those transcendental values, those eternal values. And so we imagine that we can do it both ways, that we can serve both this world and God's kingdom, that we can give a considerable part of our energy and attention to gaining these worldly values, these earthly values that, yes, will pass away when we die, and then divide our time and energy, giving some, perhaps Sundays and other days, to these eternal values. Jesus has something to say about such people who try to serve two masters. He says very clearly in chapter 6 of Matthew's Gospel, no one can serve two masters. He makes this an absolute statement, that we cannot serve both the world and God, that we cannot serve both worldly values and eternal, transcendental values. One will either hate one of these and love the other, or be attentive to one and despise the other. And if there's any doubt as to what he's talking about, he goes on to say, you cannot give yourself both to God and to money. The word that is used there in the original Greek is mammon, and it's translated as money in the New American Bible. We could translate it as these worldly values. He's saying that it is impossible to give yourself both to these worldly values and to these transcendental values, that it has to be one or the other. We simply do not have the time and energy here upon earth to serve both masters. It has to be one or the other. We might ask ourselves, which is the master that we have chosen? Or are we trying to serve two masters? Are we trying to do something that Jesus Christ says it's impossible to do? And then Jesus goes on and tells us, I warn you not to be concerned about your livelihood, about what to eat or drink, or what clothing to wear. He gives the example of the birds of the air and the lilies of the field, reminding us that if we do our duty, if we do the best we can to carry out what seems to be God's will for us, what seems to be our destiny, our ministry on earth, that just as God takes care of providing for the birds of the air and the lilies of the field, will he not provide much more for you, O weak of faith? Stop then being anxious over questions like, what are we to eat, or what are we to drink, or what are we to wear? Seek first God's kingship over you and his way of holiness, and all of these other things will be given to you besides. Jesus is telling us here that we do need a certain amount of the goods of this world in order to survive, in order to carry out our particular destiny on earth. But he's saying, put the right priorities in your life. Seek first God's reign over you, which means seek first those transcendental values of love and justice and peace and all of these other things that will never end, will continue to be of value 100 years or 1,000 years from now. And if we will put those first in our life, if we give our number one attention and concern to them, then he is saying that all of these other things that are also needed in order to have a proper and a full life on earth will be given to us. That God in some way will provide them. Not that we can just sit back and expect a miracle, but that God in some way will make it possible for us to have the necessary energy and time to attain these worldly goods that are needed for our particular role in life. Then Jesus concludes the 6th chapter of Matthew's Gospel with a statement that has come to be called time competency, or the sacrament of the present moment. Enough, then, of being anxious about tomorrow. Let tomorrow take care of itself. Sufficient for the day is the troubles thereof. To be a time-competent person, according to the findings of depth psychologists, we need to give as much as 9/10 of our energy and time and attention to the here and the now, to the things of today. And that we only need to give about 10 or 15% of our time and attention either to looking to the past, to discern what wisdom we can from our experiences of the past, or to see whether we have done something wrong in the past that we need to now make amends, to make restitution. Or to give some time to the future, planning for the things that we have to do tomorrow and the next day and so on. That we need to give a certain amount of time, but it's only about 1/10 or 1/8 of our time and energy. That most of our time and energy should be given to the here and now. That's what it means to be a time competent person. Well, the way this has been expressed by spiritual writers in the past, they call it the sacrament of the present moment. That each moment that God gives us is like a sacrament. That each moment of time and of life that we have, God gives us a special grace. That it's a sacramental presence of God that is there to help us carry out whatever is the particular task of the present moment. And that if we will give our full attention to the here and the now, let tomorrow take care of itself sufficient for the day is the trouble thereof. Seek first God's kingship, God's reign over you, and His way of holiness and wholeness. And all of these other things will be given to you besides. Living then in the present, trusting in God to take care of our mistakes of the past and to take care of our needs of the future. According to the teaching of Jesus here in the Sermon on the Mount, that this is one of the very best ways to make sure that we build our life on the solid rock of faith, hope, and love of God. Those three basic virtues that will enable us to put those transcendental values, those everlasting values that continue to be of value after we die and for all eternity. That's the solid rock that Jesus says we must build our life here upon earth. If we do this, Jesus says very clearly that He will never abandon us, that He will always be there to help us. And so we read in the 7th chapter of Matthew's Gospel those very familiar words that I think every Christian knows. Ask and you shall receive. Seek and you shall find. Knock and it will be open to you. For whoever asks will receive. Whoever seeks will find. And whoever knocks will enter. So Jesus is telling us that He will never abandon us, that He will always be present, that He's always there waiting to give us the things that we need. He tells us that we must ask for them, that we must remind ourselves of our dependence on God, our need of God. The person who never asks God for help is almost always a proud person, a person who thinks that himself or herself is all important or is self-sufficient. It's the person who refuses to ask for help, who tries to do it all oneself. That is not the way God says we should live. That we should be humble enough to recognize our dependence on God and on others too. We should be humble enough to ask for help from God and from others. He also says that we should seek. That we just don't sit back and do nothing and expect God to take care of everything. We are obliged to use whatever energy and intelligence we have to seek out those everlasting values. And also to seek out the necessary worldly goods that we need to carry out what seems to be God's will for us, God's destiny. Whatever seems to be our ministry, our best way of practicing these three relationships of love. Seek and you will find, for whoever seeks will find. So we have to make some effort on our part. God is not approving of laziness here. We are obliged to work as best we can, but He assures us that He will be there to help us. And he who knocks, it will be open. We have to keep knocking. We have to make the effort. We have to let God know that what we want and that we are turning to Him for that help. These words then are just so consoling as we continue our journey here upon earth. To show the need that there is for us to work hard and to do the best we can to carry out God's will in all three of these areas, our relationship with God, neighbor, and self. Jesus makes this statement in the Sermon on the Mount. None of those who cry out, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of God, but only the one who does the will of my Father in heaven. So it's not just enough to sit back and do nothing and just call to the Lord and expect Him to do it all. Jesus is telling us that we have to work out our salvation. St. Ignatius Loyola made the statement that we should work as though everything depended on us and pray as though everything depended upon God. I think perhaps I would like to reverse that we should pray first and then work. That prayer comes first. We should remind ourselves of our total dependence on God, but then it means that we do whatever our conscience and our common sense tells us is God's will for us here and now. Matthew brings the Sermon on the Mount to a conclusion by telling us the reaction that the teaching of Jesus had upon the people of his time. Jesus finished this discourse and left the crowds spellbound at his teaching. The reason was he taught with authority. I think we must try to capture something of that same attitude that the people had there in Galilee when they heard these words of Jesus the first time. We're told that they were left spellbound. If we are completely open to these words of the Sermon on the Mount, we also should feel spellbound, because it is a new teaching. It's a teaching that goes so contrary to most other teachings. The reason was that he taught with authority. We will not feel spellbound by the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount unless we convince ourselves that what Jesus is saying is spoken with the authority of God himself. That what we have here in the Sermon on the Mount has the authority of absolute divine truth, of everlasting truth. Only if we can capture something of the authority with which Jesus spoke these words can we expect to find ourselves spellbound. And what does it mean to be spellbound? It means to be won over by these words of Jesus, to be so convinced of the truth of them that regardless of how difficult it might be, regardless of the price that we have to pay, that we are determined to carry them out, even if it kills us, even if it means our death, that nothing, absolutely nothing, is going to stand between us and carrying out each of these teachings of the Sermon on the Mount to the best of our ability. If we do that, then we will have built our house on the solid rock of Jesus Christ and His Word. This is the end of the conferences on the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount.